Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDooley. And we're across from Annabelle Crabb, who's come and talk about a new book, Special Delivery. Welcome, Annabelle.
It's called Special Guest, John.
I haven't wrote it down. What a fucking moron.
Special Delivery.
This
such
is gold.
A suggestive
title.
Yeah,
this is the third,
going brilliantly already.
This is the third time. Because I did Kitchen Confidential. I called it in the last podcast instead of Kitchen Cabinet.
So yeah. And then when I came in with the wife drought.
Yep.
Ended up being the man drought.
Tradition now.
It's the details it's the attention to detail that I come to expect from Booktopia that just keeps me coming back.
Well, we welcome you back all the time because we like being schooled again and again and again. So what's this book called?
So do you think like someone will buy this cookbook from your website and end up with like Mark Latham's cookbook or something? It'll just be like...
Mark Latham and Alan Jones.
Yes.
Don't forget, Alan Jones brought a lot to that book.
Yeah, he sure did.
No, I'm happy to keep going with this.
Yeah, let's
podcast.
Do it.
I'm in.
Yeah, let's... Right. I look, you know,
no deal with it.
Yeah, we can... Now, mention...
So, special guest.
Yeah. Special guest.
That's what it's called, yes.
Recipes for the Happily Imperfect Host.
Yes.
Yes. And we'll be looking through this book over the weekend. And not only do you get the recipes, you do get your little lovely introductions to each of the recipes. Can you tell us why this book came about and what's the purpose of this book, apart from sharing wonderful recipes with everyone?
Well, I read it with my best friend from childhood, Wendy Sharp. We grew up in the same little patch of the Adelaide Plains, and we both love cooking. She sadly lives in London now, so we write books together by email pretty much, and I don't get to see her very often. And that's annoying because I don't get to eat her food very often. She's a great cook. But we wanted to write a book. Our last book, Special Delivery, which you've generously mentioned, was all about food that you can take to people's houses. And, you know, like it's a great Aussie tradition to take food to people's houses. But this book is about cooking in your own home for your friends. And I just get this feeling that cooking for people is getting more and more complicated because if you invite six people around for dinner, you're bound to get somebody who's celiac and somebody who's sort of funny about shellfish or somebody who's who's vegan or something like that. And so I think people often get a bit intimidated by the task of cooking for people with different dietary requirements. Also, I mean, this is probably just my time of life, but I find if I invite six people around that I want to cook for, they all bring their children, and then next thing you know, you've got 30 people in your house, you know. So cooking for people does become a bit of a knotty proposition in those circumstances. So we have put together a whole bunch of ideas of ways that you can cook for people that you know and love when you want to entertain them, but that don't give you a nervous breakdown. And we set about this task by thinking, well, people often think, well, you invite people around, you've got to invite them around for dinner for some sort of three-course horror that involves you sobbing in the kitchen, you know. within half an hour of the arrival of your treasured friends. So we came up with a bunch of ideas of how to entertain people differently. So there's a whole chapter on invite people around for breakfast because then you get a nice breakfast, you get to see your friends, and then you can have them out of the house and be retiring with a book by 11 a.m. Or they've just stayed the whole day.
This is seriously breakfast, not brunch. Like, so we're going...
No, breakfast.
8:30
breakfast.
Start, that kind of thing?
Yep.
Or,
yep.
I like it.
Yeah, the brunch, I don't know. I think the brunch is misleading.
It lingers.
Yeah.
It's just lazy breakfast.
It is, yeah. So there's a whole heap of very good breakfast ideas there. And there's also my favourite chapter, which is stay for lunch, which is where you... These are my favourite kind of invitations these days and the ones that happen most often in my house because I keep a messy house, right? Like my house is messy. So one of the reasons I don't entertain more often is because I've got to tidy up the table and there's sort of kids' crap everywhere and, you know. But I don't feel anxious about it if people are just over at my house anyway because they're dropping off their children or picking them up or, you know, doing whatever. And then you just say, well, you're here. Why don't you stay for lunch? And that way, it's fiendishly clever because people's expectations are low. So the fact that you whip something up in 20 minutes that tastes nice is a delicious surprise for everyone. And you also don't have to make excuses for the fact that your house just looks like it's...
Because they're already standing in the bombshell. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right,
okay. Yeah.
I like that idea.
And so all of these recipes are quick And they are made generally with sort of pantry staples. Just like to say the phrase pantry staples. But they've all got a kind of like an unusual technique or like one ingredient that kind of makes it into something delicious. So the aim of that chapter is just make it fast and stuff that people can help you with. And then bada bing, you're there with a nice dish that everyone's just like, Carl, that's amazing. Well done. Another chapter is about bringing back afternoon tea. I'm like hardcore CWA afternoon tea where you make one thing. Like you don't faff around making mini sandwiches or your little, you know, mini food that I quite like making. You make one cake, like a big, solid, decent sized cake, and you just serve that with cups of tea or glasses of sparkling wine, whatever you prefer. And that's really good because you put a lot of effort into something, but you're not faffing around doing 100 different things. So it's quite a straightforward and quite easy washing up as well. So anyway, there's heaps of other chapters.
And also afternoon tea is one of those wonderful non-committal periods.
Totally, yeah.
But people can get so carried away.
Sure, but
They can. They can with what they're bringing out. But that time slot has an end.
Yeah. It does, and then you're going to be in your jammies watching some sort of box set by
the afternoon, like a few hours before dark. As soon as dark comes, they're out.
See you later.
Yeah. Come on, then.
And that, of course, works again for people who have small children in their company because, the small children management thing is addressed in another chapter, which is Wendy's absolutely brilliant idea, which is something called Pudding Club, right? And she gets around this whole, I've invited my friends, but then there's children and there's hundreds of people. Now I've got to cook a whole separate meal to feed kids beforehand and, you know. So her thing is invite people for proper dinner o'clock, not sort of like 5 past 5 kids dinner model. You invite them for proper grown-ups dinner o'clock and you ask them to feed their own kids before they arrive. And then when the kids arrive, you serve them this giant, excellent pudding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the kids get something, you know, you don't have to faff around making sure that they've got their 5 a day. You just give them what they really want, which is sweets, and then you sort them out in front of a movie or something, and then you can have your dinner with the grown-ups. Yeah.
A lot of this seems to be old knowledge. Are you bringing back...
Are you saying that I'm not an original thinker?
Well,
I mean,
you have been time traveling recently, and I'm thinking maybe you've been picking up some stuff. So you don't have to be that old, really, to be getting some of this stuff. But some of the things that the sort of management techniques, especially around the kids' side, seem to be things I remember now falling for as a kid.
Yeah, totally. Well, I see. When I was a kid, I grew up in country South Australia, and so if my parents ever went to a neighbouring farm for a dinner party, we'd have to sleep in the car. Like, there was no babysitting.
Yeah.
They'd just bring a few blankets and we would go to sleep in the car outside the house where our parents were having dinner. Like, it was hardcore. I remember once my dad saying to us, as the three of us sort of settled down for a bitter, lonely night in the car, I remember saying, like, kids, don't come out and try and find us because there are dogs loose on this property. I'm like, well played, Dad. So like, I just think that if my kids are getting dessert, well, that's evolution.
It's a step up, yeah. That's a big step up. So I've touched on your recent time travel, you seem to be involved more in TV in the last little period than ever. And there's a new show coming.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the new show? Because it's going to coincide with the release of this book.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I'm just anticipating lots of events where I'm talking about geopolitical misadventure and scones. This is perfectly normal. So the new show is called Tomorrow Tonight, and it's I co-host the show with Charlie Pickering. And it's sort of, I remember when Charlie first rang me to explain the thesis of the show, and I'm like, that is ambitious, and I'm very interested. And if it doesn't come off, then we never spoke. But it's really come off, actually, so which is a relief for everybody concerned. So what happens is a half-hour show, and in each show we are inventing a scenario and we are making it look as though it's actually happening. Mm-hmm. So a political event or a technological development occurs that throws up all sorts of moral decision-making conundrums for policymakers. And in each show, we've built that scenario with fake news reports, fake social media, so it looks like it's actually happening. So you're in this scenario and thinking, okay, so what do we do now? Do we let this happen, or is this an immoral decision to make? We have people on the panel who are genuine experts in the field of that particular event. And we also have a comedian because it's going to be funny. And the ones that we've filmed so far have been really surprising. They just go places you don't necessarily expect. One of the things, like if you throw up a moral conundrum at somebody, like, I don't know, should, if the technology exists for people to be able to design babies without any kind of sickness, or if you could design them to your exact specifications of skin colour and eye colour and personality and so far, how far would you let that go? And when you hear people's answers, when they're put on the spot, it's really interesting, particularly as we develop the scenario and make it more and more complicated and more full of moral minefields. So, yeah, that's what the new show is.
Sounds awesome.
Look, I like it. I really like working with Charlie because he is he's a very funny guy. He's very smart. But he's also he likes making television that's useful. You know, there's always something serious or pithy going on underneath his comedy. And he wanted to make this show because it feels like our world's changing really quickly, and particularly technology is creating all of these moral issues that we didn't have to worry about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so this show is an attempt to engage with a few of those and rehearse these situations before they happen.
That sounds good, because I've been very lonely and alone in my car listening to Sapiens and then Homo Deus.
Oh, okay. Gosh.
No one to talk to.
You need perking up.
Yeah, without anyone to talk about all these moral problems. And this is going to be a great show, because it's going to be
a lot of those things.
You've had a lot of experience with our wonderful political environment.
Yes, isn't it? Isn't it marvellous?
Yeah. And you know, early on you wrote books about Labor Party and their problems. And you've been involved at the centre of all this stuff as it's sort of gotten weirder. And when you're talking about positing crazy scenarios, a couple of years ago you and Charlie may have said, imagine if Donald Trump became president. And we're living through these.
We were talking about a scenario, and I think we've now dumped it because it's all sort of essentially happened, about diplomatic relations opening up between North Korea and the US.
And he's just gone and done it.
It's done. Dennis Rodman was involved.
And he said something. And he said something the other day about they're lovers, or he loves him, or
I can't even.
But so, as a political commentator, as the world gets weirder and as things that just weren't even considered are now commonplace, how do you use a tool that you've sharpened over the years with expecting things to get better that is now just going in the absolute opposite direction? And what are your fears for our future as people turn off from politics because it's just getting ridiculous?
One of the biggest dangers right now about politics, and this is really evident in Australia, is that consensus is bad for business, both in politics and in media. So if you have a look at the way politicians try to keep attention and try to build support for themselves, allowing themselves to be re-elected. One of the difficulties is that because politics has become more tribalised, because people, I mean, if you have a look on Twitter, you will see how shrill some of the extremes of politics have become.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a tribal thing, you know, you're either on this side or you're on that side. And that is an approach that finds its most ear-splitting form in hot-button issues like freedom of speech, like identity. And in those circumstances, political leaders who have a shrinking stock of reliable media outlets that contact and reach a majority of the population, I mean, if you go back 15, 20 years, you knew where people got their news and you knew how to reach them through those news sources. Now, seeing as all of that has splintered and you've got so many people getting news about the world through social media and through certain personally gardened sources of news so that they only hear from people that they already agree with, the only way the politicians now see to build support is to be louder in support of the causes that they think their most likely audience fully support. And in those circumstances, it becomes bad for business for them ever to find areas of flawed agreement with an opponent, which is what Parliament should be all about, right?
Yeah.
The whole point about democracy is you never get exactly what you want, ever. You know, it is a crapshoot sometimes, and you are forced to deal with or coexist with people with whom you disagree. And yet, one of the reasons that democracy is doing badly at the moment is because no one wants to do that. And for political figures who are trying to get enough votes to stay in the system, they're unable to sacrifice their own identity as a member of the tribe that they lead sufficiently to cut a deal with the other side, which is what consensus is, right?
Yeah.
And I think if you take a classic example, which is climate policy in this country, I mean, I did wrote an article during the recent leadership crisis called A Brief History of Seven Killings, Climate Policy in Australia, which is about how both sides of politics have failed to reach consensus on this issue, even where consensus existed,
yeah.
Which has been the case at a number of points in our history over the last 10 years.
Yeah, there's some really close moments over the years, haven't there?
Where yeah, absolutely.
And in fact, out at one point.
And in fact, a couple of months ago, you would say, well, on paper, this is a parliament that's very close to consensus because you had Malcolm Turnbull and Josh Frydenberg running energy policy for the coalition and Bill Shorten and Mark Butler running it for the ALP. And I really like their actual views are not all that different. There's not that much space between them. And yet in the end, while Malcolm Turnbull could, I think, quite possibly have got his policy through the parliament with the support of Labor votes, even if he couldn't get everybody on his own side, he wouldn't even ask for that because it would have been such a destructive proposition for him personally, and it was destructive of him anyway. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's it's extraordinary to me because I just think, Jesus, we built this beautiful house, this building, Parliament House, and its job is for people to get together and not be jerks about, like, not be so insistent on their own views and so inflexible that they are capable of, in the interests of democracy, finding a messy compromise that isn't perfect for anybody but is what we decide. I mean, Canberra itself is a messy compromise. We built that city because nobody in Melbourne and Sydney could agree about whether this bloody parliament should be in Melbourne or Sydney, and yet that art of compromise is really suffering at the moment.
Do you feel that some kind of personal, I don't know, whether it be vocation or whatever, but it seems to be that when you do your TV shows and you talk to these people, you bring them out as individuals and as humans. When you did The House, you were in all offices all over the place and showing the different points of view. And in doing that, you actually show them for the real people that they are. And they have differences, but they're not that different.
Yeah.
And yet when we pull back and we let the tabloids and the headlines get us, they seem so different.
But that's because Discord is a business model. Yeah. I mean, you can't ask Roger Ailes because he's dead, but when he set up Fox News, it was a brilliant political strategy and a business strategy because it's like, let's just broadcast to people who hate this group of people, and that's what our content will be about. It's just like, you're right, they're assholes. Like, and being part of a tribe is really great fun. Like it is, and it makes you feel like you belong in a way that this smashed up world doesn't always readily make you feel. Like it's actually a panacea to anxiety. And
but
it's also a great
sports for, right?
Huh?
That's why we have sports.
You're right. Okay, but like if you can sportify politics, brilliant. So, I mean, But I always think if you believe in democracy, and if you really do believe in it, then you've got to take some, you've got to take some hits to the chin. Like, I mean, because your people that you like will never always win, right? And I always think, well, if someone's been elected to parliament, it's because a bunch of people have voted for them, right? Mm. And I work for the National Broadcaster, which should be talking to people that reflect all points of view in Australia. Like every now and again I get in strife for, you know, having someone on Kitchen Cabinet that a bunch of people hate or, you know, think that, well, how dare you humanise this monster. And recently when Sarah Ferguson interviewed Steve Bannon, there was a lot of that too. Like there's this idea that, you know, if someone is has done terrible things or, you know, has authored policies with which, you know, a certain proportion of the population think are offensive or whatever, that they shouldn't be given a platform to speak or you shouldn't hear from that person. I always am a bit puzzled by that because I think if I'm horrified by somebody or their policies or, you know, and they're kind of, you know, spreading this kind of philosophy around, then I always think it's much more useful to talk to them than to not talk to them because, you know, this is a world where no one is ever going to be without a platform, you know. Like you can build your own platform so easily by not putting them on the ABC or the whatever. You're not denying them a platform. They make their own platform and, you know, build an army. So why not? Anyway.
I was thinking about it before when you were talking that journalists at the moment seem like the kids in a messy divorce. Like they're sort of between these two parties and they're spending time with one and the other. But now they seem to be, because of your earlier description, out in the car sleeping.
Yeah, nice bringing back.
Bringing on back.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, don't forget, journalism is undergoing its own huge revolution. You know,
do you feel that journalists are getting toppled into that side or this side, that there are more sort of
partisan journalists? No, I think that our instinct is still to try and be even-handed. Mm. But
because there's money to be made.
Of course, that's right. That's the thing.
There's money to be made by following one of
the other. Of course there is, and that's the danger, is that you weaponize discord or you commercialize it.
Mm.
And if you can't get actual journalists to present this stuff, then you get bots to present it, or you fake up news, and it kind of is useful as fodder to confirm the beliefs of people who are extreme in their beliefs. See, I've never been an extremist. I'm too full of doubts ever to really subscribe to an ideological extreme or... I mean, this is why I'd be no good in politics, because I'm always just like, oh, right, no, you do have a point, actually.
That's what the brilliant thing about your show is that you do that, and it's really annoying to people who have, like, fanatical views.
I know, right?
You go, I'm listening to the wrong guy.
I know, I always get yelled at for that. But I don't know, you can't help the way you are, I suppose. Like, that's just how I think, and I am always really interested in people who have differing political views, or because it's always just I'm most interested in seeing how they got to that spot, because
have to try and understand it.
Sure.
You're never going to have any kind of useful discourse with anyone if you can't see where they're coming from.
Well, of course
even
not.
If it's wrong.
Yeah.
That's what novelists do. Like, that's the great thing about so many novels is you get to see the other side and you get to see both arguments
and
you sort of walk in other people's shoes a bit more. Can I talk to you just before we wrap up, because we're going over time, but I can't help myself. This strange thing that has been growing outside of your normal career, this Chat 10.
Oh, yeah.
Looks through. That just keeps happening. This podcast that you and Lee Sales do, and then now these live shows.
You want to go with strange thing or, like, vital life-saving things? Like, I'm going to go with vital life-saving.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's so random, really. I mean, we started doing it, I don't even know how long ago, maybe a couple of years. Lee and I just started doing it's not very technologically proficient. We started off just having a conversation and recording it on a phone and then just popping it up on iTunes. And I don't know. I mean, we have differing recollections of why we started it. I'm pretty sure that we started it because we found that although we really enjoyed talking to each other, we didn't really get all that many chances with busy jobs, lives, babies, that sort of thing. And I thought, well, if we made it into something that was light work, like where we were making content, then we probably would prioritize it more. And so But we just did it on our own because we didn't want to have any – we wanted to have the freedom to just stop any time if it stopped being fun. But actually it's just been this tremendous kind of fun. And what we found really fast was that people really got into it and were downloading it, and we never really promoted it in any way. It was a word of mouth thing. And then we couldn't work out how to read the audience stats on the Squarespace or whatever it is. And like sales kept saying like, it says here that there's 180,000 people listening. I was like, oh, the bollocks, that can't be right. So I can't, you can't read the thing. Yes, I can. No, you can't. You're an idiot. Like, yeah, I probably can't read the thing. So I don't know, for ages we just didn't quite recognise the size of the audience. And then someone who did know how was like, girlfriend, like there are lots of people listening to this thing. And then they were all trying to talk to each other through us. And then so we set up a Facebook group, which went absolutely gangbusters. And it's just full of all these nice people being pleasant to each other. So it's quite a sort of revolutionary social media interaction. There's about, I don't know, there's 30,000 people who just go and drop cakes to each other. And, yeah, and with all these incredibly wonderful stories of kindness, you know, they just all are like this big family that help each other out, and people are constantly posting with.
But there are totems as well, like the bird thing and the. Like, there's just like
There's lots of in jokes.
Yeah,
it's a great
and so, which kind of come out in the podcast, and then are like, and we've actually now we've been doing live shows because people were asking us to, and also we've now had to kind of hire someone to moderate the Facebook group because it's like this giant. It's like it's like a small country. It needs a dictator. So, and neither of us are going to be that dictator. And so, it's lovely, actually. We've met so many wonderful people, and it's also a really nice place to hang out because you go there and think, oh, look, you know, the world is, you know, does contain a lot of people who are love thinking about things and reading and,
yeah,
being good to each other.
Yeah, it's definitely
vital and life saving.
Yeah, yeah, that,
my favorite one was where this, like, one of our chatters found an injured racing pigeon in Newcastle, and she's like, "I found this pigeon. He seems to be injured. His name, I'm going to call him Gary. That book called Gary the Pigeon." And she's like, "I think he lives in Wollongong from the leg tag." Is anyone going to Wollongong from Newcastle? And within 1 minute, this other woman had gone back and said, actually, weirdly enough, I'm going to Wollongong to scatter my dad's ashes today, so I'm happy to pick up Gary. So she took a pigeon. Now they're all friends. It's just hilarious.
So good.
Nice ending for Gary. Yeah.
Well, the special guest, the book is, I like this, because one of the things that really comes across with your friendship with Lee Sales, and Lee Sales talks about in her books as well, is community and friendship coming together in times of need, and like, I mean, you guys get given food all the time now.
Yeah.
And I think this special guest book is like that. It's preparing you for, you know, opening your house and opening your time.
I mean, everybody is incredibly busy, you know, and yet you can still find a time economic way to do what food does, which is to say, I love your company. I would love to make you dinner or breakfast or lunch, and I'm going to put a bit of effort in, and this is how I'm going to express my affection for you. And I love that. Like, I love the idea of food as a language. And one thing that we've tried really hard to do with the book too is to make it inclusive so that you feel like you're including everybody, even your, you know, crazy vegan friend or whatever. Because, like, I always feel that the vegans, you know, they always get, like, here's your eggplant. Just an eggplant.
Do you know how to cook it?
I know, right? Like, everybody else is having this, and here's your dish. So we've got heaps of recipes in there where you can cook a big feast, and it adapts itself really well to people helping themselves to the bits that they like and can eat, right? Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, cooking a feast where people help themselves does actually make it really, it's fun. And it also looks after people in a way that makes them feel like you planned this dinner for them. They're not just a tack on, add on because they happen to be celiac or, you know, vegan or halal or whatever.
Yeah.
So we've also got, because Wendy and I love a novelty index. In the last book we had an index that was like by occasion. Like, you know, why are you taking food to your friend? Ill, depressed, had a baby, celebrating a new job or something. So, like, what are the appropriate foods to take? Like, do not take a depressed person a salad that needs to be sort of prepared and tossed on the day, like, or something, because what will happen is that that depressed person will not eat that salad and then it'll sit in the fridge, making them feel more depressed yeah. as it goes off. Like, don't do that. Take them some nuts. Well, this novelty index at the end of this book is, which of these dishes are okay for vegans? Which are okay for gluten-free people? And in each recipe where it's appropriate, we've suggested two different kinds of hacks. One, how do you make this even easier? And two, how do you make this gluten-free, vegan or whatever? So if you've got like a mixed bunch of vegans and celiacs and whatever coming over, go to the index. You'll be right. Don't feel intimidated. Do not feel vegan fear.
Annabelle, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
It is always a pleasure. Lovely to see you.
Annabelle, the author of Man Drought and... you can get all of Annabelle's crabs. There's a great diversity of names at booktopia.com.au.
You can readily recall. They're all there.
They're all there, those other ones, the other books that she's done. Yeah, quoting you, Andrew Katnack. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.